Son! Wait, you don't have to do this.
Go away, Kate.
I want to know about your research.
Son,
what happens to pregnant women?
You're pregnant.
Are you sure?
How do you know?
I asked you a question.
Everyone else might be all right with you washing your clothes and eating our food.
I want to know what's going on.
I want answers. What are you people doing? Why are you taking children? What happens to pregnant women on this island? What happens?
They die. They all die.
Everybody with me, D.O.C. Hey, y'all, who you came with? Who you leaving with? Sorry, that's just been stuck in my head for about a week, and I just had to get that out, Mike.
Is that DJ D.O.C.
now? DJ D.O.C.
The popular knockoff of DJ Dom. Mm-hmm. Like the, sort of like an, I wouldn't say West Coast, East Coast rivalry, more like Western, Eastern rivalry as we talk about Korea today.
He is the fertility DJ. DJ D.O.C.
Ooh.
Yes.
Okay, exactly. Like, hey, I'm going to spin you a rhyme while I tell you what's going on with your baby. And Josh, let me be the first to tell you.
행복한 12월.
That means happy December in my native tongue of Korean.
Happy December, Mike. I can't even believe it. We're almost through, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we are at... To use a lost term, the beginning of the end for 2020. Oh.
Well, we're still several weeks away from the beginning of the end, the episode of Lost, but we are in the home stretch here of season 3, as we've been saying for a while, and I think that this is the last, like, you know, more closer to middle of the road episode that we're getting before we really go full throttle starting next week until the mm-hmm. until the finish. So, exciting times here on the Lost podcast, Mike Bloom.
Yeah, I mean, it's I cannot believe that we've gone here. You know, season 3 has been such an eventful season in so many ways. And this is an eventful episode, you know, even if, like you said, it is not nearly as bombastic as what is to come. But what is, really? What I took note of, Josh, actually doing my research on Lostpedia, my due diligence like I do every week, apparently this is the final episode in Lost that really has a flashback that focuses on someone from 815 before the plane crash and does it in like one continuous stream of events. Like, of course, like Greatest Hits and Cabin Fever was more of a montage of events for the lives of Charlie and Locke, respectively. But this is the last time that we are going to have, you know, one character deal with just a stream of events through a single narrative. From here on out, things are going to change in so many ways.
Yeah, so that's not like counting like season 5, how people come back on Ajira and then we get flashbacks to what happened right before they got on Ajira. Like, that's
right. We're talking pre-crash here. We're talking pre-815. And
yep.
Only with 815. Like, well, obviously, we'll have Ben in a couple weeks. We're going to have Miles all the way and Daniel Faraday beforehand. But this is bidding adieu to what has become such like a key facet of the first three seasons of Lost. And granted, we had dalliances, you know, with your maternity leave.
We also had Dallin Cerebos.
Yeah, exactly. With your flashes before your eyes of, you know, moments they sort of stepped out of the structure. But I think this is a big thing to note, considering where we are going towards barreling down that huge twist at the end of Through the Looking Glass, that this really was the first instance that things were going to change in terms of storytelling, even though it might not outright in this episode.
So there's a lot of asterisks on that, obviously. It's like,
of course, it's very conditional.
Yeah, so it's like this is the final 815-centric passenger pre-815 crash flashback episode. Sounds like it's just like a bunch of asterisks weighing that down, but I actually do think that it is worth noting, because like that is sort of the end of an era It is, we are in this moment. You wouldn't think that of DOC, that we are like in this moment where everything is about to change in a really big way. That we are, you know, so next week we're doing a flashback that's all on island. The following week we are doing a flashback that is mostly all on island as well. Then we are doing a flashback that is snapshots of somebody's life. And then we are flashing forward. And that is where the game has changed. So in many ways, Mike, we're actually talking about like the last really standard episode of Lost.
And this definitely felt like a standard episode of Lost. You know, I do feel like I feel like I'm constantly like my horses are hanging just in the far back while I keep putting the carts in front over this podcast. But I do feel like, you know, this, and I know you would disagree about Catch 22, but I do feel like this final batch of episodes, maybe beginning with like One of Us, is really sort of like pretty standard fare, very comparable to like season one in having more hangout episodes, more camp life stuff in comparison to everything that's going on with larger things at hand with the others and everything. And I think having the flashbacks incorporated into that, you know, is part and parcel with that. And I think it's emblematic, like you say, of we do away with that and we're starting to even approach, like, I don't think there's really going to be that much fluff, for lack of a better term, in the next four episodes. There's going to be so much going on with what's coming to them and what's coming for them that they're not really going to
have... Who they're leaving with.
Exactly, that we're not really going to have time for things like, you know, Sawyer getting a mixtape for Kate, for example.
Right. I think where we are right now is sort of this mixture of... there's a classic feel to it, and by classic I mean sometimes like a little bit of a frozen donkey wheel spinning quality, while also there is this forward momentum. Like, this is going to be the episode where Mikhail is back. So we're really starting to push the ball.
Or is he?
Or is he? We're starting to push the ball down the hill, though, at least of like how Charlie's going to die. We're getting a clearer picture of that. We can talk about that in this episode. There's the urgency of now, like, oh God, Son's got to get out of here. This is not going to be good.
And I think, you know, the Ben Behind the Curtain made a great point in the Discord about this, about how this brings a lot of urgency to not only the last bit of this season, but like the entirety of season four, initially from Son's perspective, but I would say almost Jack and Kate's perspective as well, too, of like, okay, we need to get off the island, if only to get this pregnant woman off the island as well.
Yeah, so that's a big piece. And then, of course, the ending of this episode, while it's not as like funny as the whole truth, the ending of this one is really important and drops a huge mythological bombshell on us that at the time was very discombobulating, to use that word again. It the idea that everyone on 815 is allegedly dead, that's very charged and certainly doesn't help with the crowd that's, you know, it was purgatory.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
Essentially now the bullets being loaded in the gun of they were dead the whole time, even though it's completely erroneous.
Yes, but like I think that it's not a nothing deal, and obviously to the greater world, the idea of 815 having gone down and being recovered and everyone being dead, I think is a really important piece of the story moving forward, and it comes here. And I've been saying for a while that like DOC is probably the episode that I remember the least when it comes to Lost. And
now, isn't just because someone paid you $100,000 to not remember the
episode? It could be. It's possible that that's what's going on. Because I got to say, Mike, after having watched it, yeah, like, is this like a miraculous episode of Lost? Absolutely not. But I think it's a very good episode of Lost.
Solid.
And I am at this place where, like, there is a part of me that thinks maybe, and I'm talking to the Quan expert here, you love Jin and Sun.
I do.
So we'll talk it through, but I think maybe this is my favorite Jin and Sun episode.
Wow. Yeah, that's definitively a hot take. I think a lot of people turn to, you know, episodes like, or specifically House of the Rising Sun, or even stuff like G-Eon, which has more of a unique storytelling style. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting considering that you think this is one of the greatest Sun and Jin episodes, considering that in the present timeline, they don't spend the episode together whatsoever.
They don't, but that happens a lot when you think about Jin and Sun, to be honest.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, is if we're sort of looking at microcosms of what's the shape of things to come, as it were, having the two of them separate for the entire episode is a nice indicator of where essentially the second half of Lost is going to be.
They're forecasting, right? They're letting us know. They're giving us the signal. So we'll talk about it all. Maybe you can talk me down, or maybe I can talk you up. We'll see how that goes. Either way, before we get into it, let's take a quick second to thank our sponsors for this episode. Support for this podcast comes from Pluto TV. Need an escape? Drop into Pluto TV for a world of free TV. Stream hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and shows, all for free. Yeah, free. No subscriptions, no fees. Imagine 24/7 channels of Narcos, CSI, Star Trek, Survivor, and everything else from hit movies to binge-worthy TV shows, the latest news, live sports, comedy, and more. What are you waiting for? Download the free Pluto TV app for Android, iPhone, Roku, and Fire TV and start streaming now. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free. Mike Bloom, we go forth into the jungle to discuss DOC, written by your guys, Eddie Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. It's directed by Fred Toy, who is a great director who directed, I don't want to spoil it, but one of the most important episodes of Westworld Season 1, certainly, that involves a certain bunker location and somebody revealing themselves to be somewhat different than what we thought them to
Jaffa
be.
Jaffa doesn't sound like anything to me.
It doesn't sound like anything to me either. Although it was, there was this moment when they returned to the staff in this episode, Mike, where it's like, this reminds me a lot of Westworld. And then I looked and saw who the director was like, that makes a lot of sense. That tracks.
Yeah, essentially, you know, Delos at a certain point did kind of look like, I think Westworld Season 2, the innards of the Delos Corporation looked a lot like the staff in terms of just being so derelict and torn apart and chaos everywhere.
Is the Delos Corporation just the future Dharma Initiative?
I mean, they don't, but they both begin with D.
I think that's a tell. I think that's letting you know everything right there. So let's get into the episode. Before we even begin, are we really not going to talk about how this episode is called DOC, but it doesn't focus on Doc Shepard?
Yeah, that's really strange, right?
They should have saved that for Jack.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. I mean, he also doesn't directly deal with DOC except for this one hot second when he like, he's like, hey, you okay, son? All right, bye.
I love this. So the episode begins. Son is back at the garden. It's been a minute.
It's been a long time. And maybe it was because like now that we're in a post expose world when she knows that she was not kidnapped by the other. She's like, oh, it was just stupid Sawyer and Charlie. Okay, now I can garden again.
Yeah, so she's like, I feel safer now. So she's working on it. And here comes Jack. He's got that red cut off again, and it's just a disastrous look. It's so bad.
It's really just, I don't think it's working well for his skin, maybe, is what
weird
it is.
Weird contrast. Strange color.
Does this come back when you know, he finds his way into Naomi, or Naomi finds his way to him next episode? I can't remember if he's still wearing it.
I don't know. I think this is another thing that I was paid $100,000 to forget. So Jack, he just wants to check in with Sun about her pregnancy, and he's asking her all of these questions. And when he asks any bleeding, she gets a little concerned. She's like, why are you asking me about any of this? And he's like, well, I've been gone for a minute. I just want to make sure you're all right. And she's like, I'm fine. And Jack's like, all right, cool. Then I'll leave. So Jack was there for like 2 seconds. Like, I was going to help you with your garden. And he like helped her for like a minute. So
yeah, I remember he's like, oh, there's some aloe here. This also does beg the question, because we're going to find out later. And we actually did hear, you know, in the opening clip a bit that Kate's going to reveal what Juliet told them in One of Us. Why did Jack not tell Juliet about Sun, or did he off screen?
I don't know. I don't know if he's told her anything. Maybe there's a certain degree to which he wants to like keep certain aspects of the camp life close to the vest. Maybe there is like the doctor patient confidentiality thing. Maybe what he could have done was go to Sun and be like, hey, so I'm not going to tell Juliet, but she is a fertility doctor. And, you know, I would recommend, I trust her. Do you trust me? That classic line that I like to say.
Right.
Do you want to talk to Juliet? Because maybe she'd be somebody worth talking to.
Yeah, because the thing for me is, you know, obviously you found out a couple of episodes ago that, you know, Claire was in some sort of danger or like was some sort of interest to the others, that they were specifically interested in pregnant women. You would think that even to your point, like a tip off to the only current pregnant woman on the island right now of like, hey, just so you know, this is what's happening. Like, yes, people have their reservations about Juliet even after she saved Claire. But I feel like you would want to make that connection. I mean, especially if Jack's MO right now is to try to ingratiate Juliet into the group. I don't know. It feels counterintuitive to sort of keep her at arm's length and not disclose this information to Sun.
I think he probably needs Sun's permission. would be my guess. But I mean, rules are kind of out the window. They're on the island,
especially when you know the other person that is part of the part of, you know, party to that information is someone like Kate, who is just like, yeah, I'm going to spill it later on to really just like undercut you, Jack.
Yeah. So I don't know. Much like last week, things could probably be handled a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
Flashback time. So Sun is on the phone with Jin, wearing his sweet Pake Industries jacket, which I want it.
What's the deal with this, though? Because they said that, what, like, Jin was working on the floor or something. So is this, like, some sort of uniform that he's wearing?
I have no idea.
I don't understand the whole double shirt thing.
I love this, like, robin's egg color that it's got, and it just looks lovely.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's also like a Pake psychology thing. I have not looked into whether, you know, coral blue or whatever it was tends to have people fall under your submission even more. But maybe that's what he did subtly with color theory.
I like to say robin's egg blue, Mike. Robin's bloom. They're talking to, I love you madly, they say to each other. And Mike, oh my God, it just, you know, I just love it. I love it. I love it madly. I love that what they say to each other.
Well, and this is also like, you know, when we're tracking the chronology of the Kwans, this is probably shortly after their wedding, right? Because Jin is in their, like, newly, or not even newly furnished, just new apartment in general. This is obviously pre-Bopo, and it's obviously pre-Jin becoming under the thumb of Mr. Pake. So this is clearly in the still white flower phase of, like, this is a young couple in love. For lack of a better term, the honeymoon phase is still on here. And so, you know, they are very much madly in love with each other, which informs, I think, the way that Sun is going to really do stuff in this flashback to make sure that sort of visage of happiness and serenity is held up even in the most trying circumstances.
Well, I think that this episode shows that there are so many ways in which Jin is, you know, we've seen on Lost, there are many ways in which Jin is willing to compromise and sell versions of himself out to protect Sun. Right? Like, mm-hmm. We've seen him, like, beat the crap out of the guy, like, effectively become a hitman almost, on Mr. Pake's behalf and keep that secret from Sun so as not to break her heart. And that he's doing all of these things for her, for their family, for their marriage. And I think in this episode, you're seeing some of the things that Sun is willing to compromise and sacrifice in order to protect Jin. You know, there are ways in which both of these people have withheld really big pieces of information from each other that I think is both like tragic and sad, and yet on a large scale, even if like it's highly dramatized, I think the concept behind it is well-worn, familiar territory for married people.
I think also when you're talking about like sacrifice from the level of Sun's part, that is a facet that I feel like we haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
Because like you said, we've definitely seen the Jin side of the equation, specifically from like the Ins translation of it all, specifically with the stuff he's had to go through. And, you know, when he yells at her in that infamous sink scene of like, basically like, I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this because your father makes me. I think our perception of Sun at that point is like, well, you know, it's the rich girl, poor guy trope. And this is someone who, you know, married.
I haven't listened to that podcast yet.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, there are a few episodes in, but don't talk about pickles, because that's when, or I guess whatever the Korean version of pickles is, kimchi. But I think that, you know, we haven't really seen Sun's perspective of like, meeting someone halfway, like you say, which is, you know, it's a key concept of not only marriage, but relationships in general, whether romantic or platonic. We haven't really seen that side of it. In fact, we've sort of almost seen the opposite, where Sun partakes in an affair with Jay Lee because she does not feel like she and Jin are meeting halfway. And now I think we do sort of get a glimpse, and that's why it tracks so beautifully to what is far and away the best scene of the episode, which is going to be the actual DOC itself, which, spoiler alert, we'll listen to. It tracks really nicely to the whole it's Jin's moment, this idea of personal sacrifice to help sort of like protect the safety and just do it for someone that you love. And I think that was a piece of the equation from Sun that we've been missing up to this point through these flashbacks. And while it is a little bit of like a weird storyline in general, this flashback, to see this facet of Sun's character come out, I think was a great way to see this character, when admittedly this episode made me realize, Josh, that Sun has really had not a lot to do in season 3.
They have not done much with Sun in season 3.
Yeah, I would say it's second only to Claire in terms of like the main 815ers who really haven't done much.
Trying to think. Yeah, I think that that's probably right.
Yeah, like if you count Rose and Bernard, maybe, but I do feel
it's
like
wild,
those
though,
two.
Because didn't she killed someone, man? You know?
Yeah, she killed someone in episode two.
It's been a while,
like,
though.
Slapped Sawyer and then found out she's pregnant. Those are the big three highlights
of season
three.
Well, she also set the stakes that Sawyer's not allowed to make nicknames. So, like, she's had, like, few appearances, but the impact has been serious. Whether she killed somebody, smacked somebody, or robbed someone of their greatest pastime.
That's a nice Ding Mary kill.
Yeah, right? I think that's good. Anyway, so she hangs up with Jin, and she's just sitting on a bench, and there's somebody sitting down next to her. Is like, oh, is that you in the paper? She's like, oh, yeah, that's me. I'm Sun. And she's like, yeah, I know who you are. Do you know who I am? Let me indicate to you that I am Jin's mother, and I was a prostitute, Sun. And it's like, dun, dun, dun. I'm coming back in 3 days. You got to bring me my money. Show me the money. Show me the money, or everyone's gonna know that that man who you love madly is the son of a prostitute.
Unfortunately, does not track as well as "Son of a Preacher Man" in terms of a song.
Yeah,
that was the original version. The interesting thing that I noticed, and this again speaks to, I think we've sort of been noticing the like very Amero-centric Lost writers' room, and how that can sometimes not be great when talking about other cultures. I did find it interesting that, you know, Jin's mom says, you know, essentially extorts Sun, being like, you must bring me $100,000, because Korea doesn't use dollars. So I'm intrigued as to whether this is like a direct currency exchange or whether it was like 100,000 won, which I believe is the currency in Korea.
Yeah, I have no idea. She wants 100,000 U.S. dollars. Could be. I don't know.
Maybe that's an indicator as to where like Jin's mom is going to run away to once she gets the cash. Like, yeah. I don't want to futz with any stupid currency exchange when I get to the
airport.
I'm
surprised it's not 108. To be honest with you.
Yeah, that is. I mean, maybe if it had been more Hurley centric, but. Listen, I am happy with getting this lady as little involved with the plot as usual. I'm fine if she's not affiliated with the numbers whatsoever.
The way that Jin has the best father on Lost, where does his mom rank?
I mean, this really is like a yin and yang thing, right? Like, I guess when it comes to talking about mothers, we do have Shannon's stepmother.
She's pretty awful.
It's pretty awful, Sabrina Carlisle. I would say Margot Shepherd is not a great mother either, but I don't think either one of them would try to extort someone for $100,000, being like, I'm going to shame your husband. Give me this money, please.
I think that I would actually, thinking about it a little bit more, I think that Shannon's mom is worse. Would be where I'm at. Because I think that there's also probably a lot of circumstance that if you really wanted to do the deep dive and dig really deep into this character, would at least explain why she's doing what she's doing. Must have had a very difficult life. Who knows what kind of traumas she has sustained. I think that Sabrina Carlisle has almost like no justifiable reason for doing any of the terrible things she's doing. Whereas I feel like Jin's mom, I feel like if you pried a little deeper, if not like a justification, then at least like history that explains the present. I say that and still say that she's clearly getting a bunch of LVPs this episode.
Yeah. I mean, it really is sort of like a game of inches. But it's interesting, though, because Sabrina Carlisle does give her rationale in that episode. But I think, in your opinion, it does not measure up to, like, the possible fictionalized incentive in which this lady's pursuing it.
Not really. All right. So that's, like, the thrust of the flashback. And what I like about it is, like, in that very first scene in the flashback, it's giving you, like, a really distilled, like, story engine for the flashbacks. It's like, so this is what the flashbacks are going to be about.
Like,
it's like
they drop you in right in. This is the situation. These are the stakes.
Yes. Sun versus a blackmailer. Like, I think, like, that's good. I like that. I appreciate that we're just, like, getting into that right away. Let's get into what's going on back on the camping trip, as everybody is still freaking out about the Naomi thing. And in fact, how about we listen, Mike? Let's cue up sound number one.
Who is she?
I have no idea.
She seems to know you, dude. She just said your name.
I've never seen her before in my life.
She's waking up.
I'm sorry.
She's trying to talk. We should get her some water.
Hey, give me a hand.
Estoy muriendo.
What's she saying? Spanish, dude.
What, do you understand her then?
Estoy muriendo. Me estoy muriendo.
She says she's dying.
Estoy muriendo.
Oh, God. It's a branch. She must have hit it on the way down.
Get up, Hank. We haven't got much in this first aid kit. Do you think there's anything we can use in there?
What if this is a rescue? What if she came for us? I mean, she can be okay. We can't let her.
Just go start looking. We'll get Jack. Jack.
We have to get Jack as soon as possible. She could be our way off the island.
No, if we move it, it'll make it worse.
Or we just let her bleed to death.
No, we need to bring Jack here.
In 8 hour walk, one way.
Then I'll run.
Be out of your mind. It's not safe. It's going to be dark soon. Who knows who's out in this jungle? In case you haven't forgotten, there are people on this island trying to kill us.
Nobody knows we're here.
Oops.
I realize in retrospect, instead of having my Korean tuned up, I should have studied up on what? Spanish, Portuguese, Russian.
Russian, yeah.
Yeah, the entire
another reason to keep Naomi on the show, man. Like, she's got a lot going on.
Yeah, she's the universal translator.
Maybe also why they had to get rid of her, though, because she knows too much.
It's a super fun Hurley moment. And what I feel, honestly, like, there's some interesting stuff here with the B-plot of Naomi in the jungle, but I do feel like it's a little bit of, like you said before, spinning our wheels, at least from this capacity, until that final scene. But, you know, to have us address what's going on immediately from the end of Catch-22, of course, needs to happen. Of course, the way that these guys are differently handling things is really going to manifest itself later on, as Desmond and Charlie, in particular, have very different feelings about the others. I forgot to make note of this last episode, Josh, but it's going to apply here, obviously. Did you notice Charlie's choice of outfit on the camping trip?
No, he has like a white shirt, like a off-white shirt, right?
So he has a white, he does have an off-white shirt, but it's less about that color, and it's more about what's on it. It is the Tree of Gondor is on his shirt.
Hey, how about that? That's a nice little Easter egg.
Yeah, which, you know, Dominic Monaghan, I'm trying to remember if Mary ends up visiting Gondor. I can't remember, but obviously a location affiliated with the Lord of the Rings franchise, and we know that Dominic Monaghan really broke big in that. So a nice little, you know, shout out to where he came from.
Yeah, very compelling, because Billy Wallace is on that beach, and I wonder if he's triggered looking at that the Horns of Gondor.
Yeah, that might be a thing where, like, he tries to take the
Tree
shirt when Charlie's on his way to the Looking Glass
station.
All right,
Rich,
you know?
If you're listening, just put that in the book. You know, we'll get there. Let me push back a little bit on the idea that the B-plot is just sort of spinning the frozen donkey wheel. I agree with that in theory, like, just like the written description, yeah. But I think that a lot of flavor comes from the interactions in this episode, both among the camping trip crew, within the camping trip crew, and also the ways in which they interact with Mikhail and the ways in which Mikhail draws things out of these people. I think that there is like a pressurized component to the B-plot this week that I find fascinating. I love seeing Charlie and Desmond at odds. I think that that is really compelling. And to see Charlie that in this moment, all these weeks removed from killing Ethan, is still really firmly on the side of like, we should not be letting these people live. I think that's fascinating to me about this guy who's at the end of his life, effectively, still having that opinion. It's another look that's maybe a little problematic for Desmond, and I think the biggest issues that I have with Desmond are the ways in which he's not accepting anybody's feedback in this. Like,
he's still continuing that mentality from Cash 22. Like, you know, Penny wasn't the one in the parachute, but he still has this mentality of like, nope, I have this idea in my head, and whatever says goes, even if, you know, someone who has much more experience with the others is telling me that what I'm doing is not good.
And I think what's fascinating about that is because of that fixation on his vision for what needs to happen in order for things to click moving forward. And I'm talking about not like his flash forward type of vision, right? Like, I'm talking about literally like what he believes needs to happen in order to make this all work. Like his instincts, his leadership instincts here, that his strict adherence to that stuff is in, at least there's an argument that he's getting Charlie killed in this episode. That his actions are going to lead to Charlie's death directly after he has spent all of this time trying to prevent Charlie's death. He kind of seals Charlie's fate in this one. So that's really compelling to me. Hurley's just hilarious in this episode. And then Jin is great. Jin is like, you guys, we can't speak the same language, but I see things that you aren't seeing, and I'm acting in ways that you guys are not ready to act, and I'm going to be a leader in my own right in this moment.
This is the most Jensen-born that Jin has been. Like, this is him really showing how, I was a hitman, I'll take someone down and kick their ass if I feel like they're up to no good.
So I love it. I think for these four characters, all of whom I really like, I think, like, even the stuff about Desmond that I find unsavory in this episode is fascinating for him as a character. So I really like the character work in the B plot. I think Mikhail and, like, the stakes that he brings to it, and the stakes of somebody who has arrived on the island who may be able to save them being on the cusp of death, I think that activates, like, some unpleasant sides, and at the very least, like, some friction within the group that I find super enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I see your points. I think just for me personally, again, after so, like, activated the previous episode, and the next episode will be with, you know, Charlie incidentally running into Jack, and then now the entire group finding out about Naomi, it just felt a little bit like, okay, we need an episode to hold them in place. What are we going to do? And like you said, there's still, you know, conversations that I think are particularly interesting. I just was not as riveted as I had been with the camping stuff both before and after this. It felt like after this big reveal that when it came to the literal elephant in the room of Naomi, whether due to injuries or plot convenience, we don't really address it that much in the course of the episode when that really is like the huge thing. You know, we talked about how big of a deal her presence was last episode. To sort of hold us in that place for an episode, again, we can understand the episode order here, how that one might have been a bit constricting with some of these episodes, and I personally felt it here. Something I wanted to indicate, we talked before about how, you know, the writers at this point were obviously teeing up how they were looking for the series to possibly end. Naomi, the first language we hear her speak in this episode is Spanish, and the first thing she says is "Estoy muriendo," meaning she's dying. Do you think at all, maybe this is me putting my own two and two together, could this be some sort of foreshadowing to Hurley being able to communicate with the dead?
Never thought about that before, but yeah, why not?
I think it could be a fun little fictionalized call out to the fact that even a few episodes from now, we're going to be seeing Hurley being able to communicate with the dead.
That superpower is coming his way very soon, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
He's just a couple episodes removed from that. I like that. All right, so let's get to another flashback here. Sun's in her apartment. She's surrounded by boxes. Did they come from a box company in Tunstall, California, Mike?
I don't know. I don't know how much Paik is, like, outsourcing his boxware, you know?
I don't know.
If so, I mean, Randy's rolling in it then, if, like, such a big conglomerate wants all of his boxes for his daughter's apartment.
So Jin comes home. He's got dinner. They're looking at all these pictures. There's a picture of her in a cap and gown. Jin has the line, "Even in a cap and gown, you're the sexiest woman I've ever seen." That's love, man. That's true love.
Yeah, I mean, listen, none of us look good on graduation day, right? Like, graduation gowns are never form-fitting. We all look like we're wearing big, colorful potato sacks.
Yeah.
Like, I think to say that, wow, you look sexy, maybe he also, you know, talks about how attractive education is as well, considering where he comes from. That could also speak to his own proclivities.
I just love that. I think that's great. I love your Dumbledore cosplay. It's so sexy.
Yeah.
And so he has no pictures of his family. We didn't have a camera growing up, and he says, and she's like, when did your father die again? Because as we sort of yada yada through, Jin's mom is like, his dad was a fisherman and he's still alive and blah blah blah. And Jin's like, no, he died when I was in the army. And I guess I'd missed the memo that Jin was in the army.
I think it might be something in Korea. I can't remember if it was like during that time or maybe before. Where like there, I feel like he maybe made a reference to it of like enlisting in voluntary service. And I think there actually might have been like a picture of him in a previous flashback of like him in fatigues. Maybe there was a mention to it. But yeah, unfortunately, no running into like your Saeeds or your Sam Austins at all.
Right. That could have been interesting, but he doesn't want to talk about his dad. He starts to get upset, and so Sun's like, oh, where there's smoke, so...
Well, I mean, she also flat-out caught him in a lie, right?
Yeah.
Like, Jin's like, oh, yeah, you know, he's like, oh, yeah, my dad, I was in the army when my dad died. She's like, but you said you were young when your dad's like, yeah, well, I was also in the army as well. Eat your tofu soup, bye.
Yeah, so that's uncomfy. All right, back at the beach... there is some stuff going on as Sun has some questions. She's gonna ask some questions of her good old BFF, Kate Austin. Let's listen in on Kate and Sun.
How's this? That's perfect. Thank you.
What do you think happened to Jack while he was with the others? Since he's been back, he seems different.
He says that he was pretty much a prisoner, and the only reason why he cooperated is because he thought they'd let him off the island.
Do you believe him?
Why wouldn't I?
He came to me, asking about my pregnancy. Well, what would that have anything to do with? What if? What if the others want my baby? He's been there alone for over a week. How do we know he isn't working with them?
He's not working with them.
Do you know something, Kate?
It's Juliet. She was their doctor, their fertility doctor, studying pregnant women. And when Claire was sick, she told me and Jack. The reason the others wanted her baby was for research.
I don't know what it is, Josh, about episodes featuring the staff and Kate reconnecting with her season one BFFs, but we are now 2 for 2.
Yeah, so she's back at it again, but only for a little while. She's barely in the episode, really.
Yeah, she really is just merely the conduit right now to get Sun connected to that scene that we heard in the opening, which is now she immediately makes a beeline for Juliet on the beach, a beach line, and then Juliet just very succinctly responds, like, yep, the pregnant woman died.
Yeah, you're gonna die if you're pregnant here. Like, it ain't good. Do you get the sense that that she is finding out for the first time about Sun's pregnancy, especially, like, based on the recording at the end of the episode?
Yeah, I would imagine so, which is interesting because I wonder, you would think that, like, Ben might have, like, had a track on that, right? I would not put it past Ben Linus if Abed style he has, like, tracked the sexual habits of 815.
Yeah, when she does the recording later, she's going to say Quan is pregnant, and she's also going to have the update that, like, Jin was infertile before he got here. And given, like, all the stuff that they know about so many of these people, I feel like the Quans would actually be among the people that they could probably research the best.
Yeah.
Because Sun is such a prominent figure.
She gets her photo in the paper when she gets married. Yeah, I can imagine that. Like, she and Hurley are probably the top two, you know, most high-profile people on the island at that point. It's a good point that, you know, Juliet is either playing it really cool or for some reason the others just have a huge blind spot.
I think that they got a blind spot, which is a little strange to me, but whatever. It's fine. You know, don't look at that. Let's keep talking about the episodes.
Yeah. Or maybe it could just be that, you know, Juliet, true to what she'll say later about wanting to give good news for once, had the information and just was withholding about it because she didn't want to give some of the bad news.
I think that takes away something from the Juliet storyline this week. I think like Juliet kind of like putting herself out there right now for what's going on with Sun feels a little purer if she doesn't have that intel. And I think also because, like, clearly I really get the impression that her interaction with Sun in this episode is the catalyst for why she's going to come clean to Jack. Like, I think, like, you don't really need much more than when she finishes the recording and says, "I hate you" off the record, to, like, get the sense that, like, she's really troubled by what it is she's been tasked to do.
I mean, this is essentially the addendum to the end of One of Us, right? Like, she's doing it, but she doesn't feel good about it.
She doesn't like it. She's, like, starting to waffle on it.
But I think that, to your point, this is a big turning point for the character because Ben told her a couple of episodes ago / a long time ago in the chronology of everything, you'll leave the island when your work is done. And theoretically, this is her work being done right now. And I can imagine after 3 years of just, like, essentially giving up hope, not only on leaving the island, but, like, having pregnant women die, to have your life's work involve people dying horrifically, that this is a glimmer of hope in so many ways that reignites a spark in this character that was long put out.
All right, so Juliet's going to be like, yeah, so pregnant ladies die here. I hope that you're not pregnant. So on the camping trip, Naomi is speaking more languages. Jin clarifies, she's speaking Chinese, not Korean. I don't know what she's talking about.
Yeah, and I lost Pia to the translations. I believe this one is also along the lines of, like, I'm dying or help me, please.
Yeah, so Desmond is starting to, like, freak out. Charlie's freaking out. They're freaking out at each other. Trouble in paradise with Desmond and Charlie, Mike.
Yeah, exactly. The island of the UK is not as beautifully simmering as the Lost Islands.
It's not as unified as it looks. So that's going on, and then they're interrupted by the return of Mikhail, who is somehow still alive after we saw him get zapped by the fence. Although, again, as we discussed, he's still breathing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I do like how flare guns are now 2 for 2 in drawing the others, whether it's Michael, please God, flare during Exodus that brought, you know, Tom Friendly to them, or now Hurley accidentally shooting the flare and bringing Mikhail to them. Like, whenever you shoot a flare, the others are going to come no matter what.
They know where you are now. So Mikhail shows up, and we've got the sound for this. Where are we starting? Are we starting with the fight fight?
No, so we're doing post-Jin beatdown, because it's just a lot of climactic music. But
great.
Jin,
then let's talk that through, because, yeah. Like, Mikhail shows up, and he's like, ooh! And then they're like, hey, and then Mikhail books it, and everyone is like looking at each other being like, are we gonna talk about it? And then Jin's like, you guys are so dumb, and he sprints off after, yep, Mikhail. He bolts after him. They get Desmond, like, then runs after Jin catches up with Mikhail in no time at all. It's a big fight scene. It's one of our it's got to be one of the very best, if not the best, Jin fight scenes on the show.
Oh yeah, well, it's also very one-sided, right? Like, Mikhail isn't really necessarily taking many swings. It's just Jin leaping into action quite literally and busting up this man's ass for the second time in several days.
It's like, for me, it's like less demerits on Mikhail's fighting style and more like, wow, Jin. Because Mikhail, like, has a few shots where, like, he almost like stabs Jin in the face with a tree branch at one point, but Jin is able to like get away in time. He pins Jin to a tree at a point, but then Jin breaks free in incredible fashion. He smacks Mikhail on the ears, which must really hurt even more than Jin knows, and then he roundhouse kicks him in the face. We simply, Mike, do not have enough MVP points to award in this episode.
Yeah,
because
there's
if we
so
did, like, I would stack 5 on Jin right now, but there are so many other MVP points that we have to consider. It's a tough week for MVPs.
Jin would be an amazing bounty hunter.
Like, yeah,
you got to take this person. Like, I'm in for the Jin DeLorean. I'm gonna travel around capturing people, roundhouse kicking their asses. Because
Jin
this is
Jaren.
Exactly. This is someone who might have been, you know, he's part of the Soviet Army. For all we know, might have actually been part of the KGB as well, considering how he's a bit of a scrapper, as we saw in Enter 77. Here's Jin, able to, you know, slip out of times when he was on the ropes and get this guy up against a tree, and in it, you know, despite the fact that this guy had a lead on them as well, Jin's like a faster sprinter than Desmond or maybe even Kate. Jin is at his height of athleticism right now.
It might be that
sperm, Josh. That sperm might have just infused him with like super soldier strength.
Yeah. What did they say? It's 5 times the normal count. And so he's just like, I'm feeling myself.
Yeah, this could be like a super soldier serum, right? It's like he's just like lightning fast now, super strong.
He's got that super sperm. All right, so Jin knocks out Mikhail, and now they're going to interrogate Mikhail, so let's listen in.
Who are you? I said, who are you?
He's the guy who shot Saeed. Kate told us he lived out in that station Locke blew up. He's an other.
I thought Locke killed that guy with the electro fence thingy.
You've got 5 seconds to talk. Why fire this gun, brother?
That's a flare gun.
And how do you think it'll feel? Taking a flare to the chest at this range?
As your friend pointed out, I already died once this week.
Aiutami. Sto. Sto morendo.
You understand her?
She's speaking Italian. She said she's dying. She needs help. I was a Soviet Army field medic. I can offer you my services.
Wait, what are you doing?
I'm saving up. This branch has punctured her lung. It's filling with blood. If it is not ventilated soon, she's going to die.
We'll do it. Help her.
If I fix her, you must let me walk away as if I never came upon you.
What you need?
All right, so we gotta stoke it. Here's the branch sticking out of the lung here, Josh. Could this, indeed, not be Mikhail Bakunin, but the smoke monster?
All right, well, you gotta be the one who leads us through this, because this is your pet theory, Mike, and I gotta be honest, I'm not seeing it.
Well, I think it's not that you don't necessarily see it. I think it's just much more of a fun theory, because what does the smoke monster want? He doesn't want the candidates on the island. The smoke monster very easily wants to get the candidates away from the island, because that means that Jacob regains control and he is, you know, trapped here forevermore. Hey, here comes somebody parachuting in who happens to be bringing information from the outside world and could help get these candidates off the island, or hell, even killed. Ka-ching, ka-ching, here we are. And so maybe it's just a matter of the smoke monster wanting to inhabit someone like Mikhail, knowing that Charlie is, you know, has a thing about the others and Desmond doesn't. This might be the perfect wedge, to your point, to sort of make these two fight amongst themselves. And, you know, obviously when Desmond puts the flare up against Mikhail, despite the blunt force trauma that Desmond was alluding to, you could say, well, he doesn't really have he already died once, or he, like, lost his urgency for life when Miss Clue died. Or it could be the smoke monster being like, yeah, dude, go ahead and try to shoot me. I'm not going to die because I'm not a real person. And also the caveat of, hey, you've got to let me, you know, walk away if I help Naomi here. It might not be him covering up his secrecy tracks, and more so like, yeah, you're going to have to let me walk away because I don't want to transform into a smoke monster and do this. This will be really awkward. I want to maintain the guise that there happens to be this unkillable other that you have to deal with now.
So how does Jin beat the shit out of the smoke monster?
I mean, how does Jack beat the shit out of John Locke?
Well, when he beats the shit out of John Locke, who's not John Locke, we're talking about the smoke monster at that point, the cork has been unplugged from the island, and now he is in, like, full-on physical form. He's physically vulnerable at that point.
Are you saying that throughout the end of season 5 and the beginning of season 6, like, there was no physical harm done to the fake John Locke at all?
He got stabbed in the chest by Saeed in season 6, and it, like, he pulls the knife and is like, why would you do that?
Right. So what I'm saying is, like, could we say, as much as we're lauding praise onto Jin, could this be a sting? Could this be like a con almost to let himself get beat up slash captured slash subdued by the camping group to then insert himself into the situation?
Yeah, but he's like sustaining actual damage, right? Like he's like actually getting like bloodied up a bit by the fight from Jin.
Yeah, but like, I mean, when he was taking the form of Yemi, he allowed himself to be bloodied up as well. Like,
did he?
I think he can take the form of anything that he wants to. He can add black eyes and stuff if he wants to.
I don't know that I've seen him like get like bloodied up before. Other than like
if he's allowed to change himself cosmetically, I'm assuming he could add bumps and cuts and bruises if he wants to.
So another thing here is, if you look at the candidates on the lighthouse and in the caves, one of the names is Dorrit. So Dorrit, who is Naomi Dorrit, who is Naomi right here. So the woman who has come here to the island potentially to rescue these people is a potential candidate. Why would the smoke monster save this person's life when by doing absolutely nothing, a candidate dies?
I mean, you have to think about the larger picture of things. She's just one of many candidates. But I think more importantly, she serves as a way to get many more candidates off this island. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few in this case of like, yeah, I could let this candidate die. But this is also the closest in years that someone has come to possibly getting these people off the island. I'm going to go for this chance when I can. Plus, again, if he's trying to sow distrust, and who's to say, like, I mean, for all we know, he could have been lying about, like, oh, yeah, she'll heal. Maybe he could have left her in critical condition anyway through his medicine work, and then it just ended up backfiring on him. I don't know. Well, if he's also not allowed to kill the candidate, would him doing nothing be a manner of killing?
No, because he didn't do anything to put Naomi in this situation, other than, he lays eyes on her.
I don't know, man. Could the smoke monster have, we asked last week what happened to the chopper. Could the smoke monster have gotten into it?
Mike, I gotta tell you, I think that this is all a stretch. This is a stretch for me. I think, like, revisiting this episode in the return of Mikhail here, it's hard for me to see why the man in black would go out of his way to do any of this stuff. I mean, and also the fact that he gets punched in the face a lot, and he seems like he's like gargling up blood
because
when he's
it's
getting
fun.
Hit and stuff.
That's much more fun to me than here is this Rasputin like figure who like can never die. It's a fun running joke, but it feels like it stretches a little bit of the believability of the island for me. I think it's more fun if Smokey has not been involved really in the season whatsoever outside of the cost of living and a little bit of Left Behind. I want to see him get involved a little bit more, and I do think the idea of rescue on this island is something that he is inherently interested in, and I think this is a way into it. Why do I go along with this theory? Because it's fun, Josh. Why did you go along with Dave marrying time-traveling Libby? Because it's fun. We do fun things on this podcast.
I'm not getting mad at you for having fun. I don't see it. I just don't see it. It's just that I don't see it. I think for Mikhail, I think Mikhail is like a super tough, like Russian hard ass. And for whatever reason, he's able to like survive what happened to him at the sonar fence. And that like he's the kind of guy that, yeah, you could shoot him with a harpoon, but you know, you really should have gone for the head.
I don't know. Like, I mean, but for that whatever reason, I'm filling in that for whatever reason. The whatever reason is because he's actually dead. And I think this is, for me, this is more appealing than just this is a regular guy. Because if we're looking into the macro sense of the series, which is this chess game between these two larger figures on the island, We distinctly have not had that really this season. And I think this is a way to have Lost Season 3 tie into that larger narrative in a way that's a bit outside the box. But I think it's a good way to look at the character and look at what the Man in Black is trying to do here. Yeah, his methods may be suspect, and arguably he does let a candidate survive. But what's to say he hasn't made mistakes before and will continue to make mistakes?
The smoke monster, I think, pretty... I think that there's going to be some room for interpretation on it. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't revisited the episode in a minute, but I'm really excited to. The Man Behind the Curtain is what John Locke and Ben see, right? The Jacob situation in the cabin, I think, is pretty clearly the smoke monster, at least for me. Right. And that is going to, you know, continue to push the path of, like, Ben is going to eventually kill Locke and Locke is going to show back up. So between that and, like, the Echo thing, I do feel like the monsters had some really big, mythically significant things that happened in season 3 of the show, with, you know, separating the Mikhail stuff out from it. But don't let me yuck your yum. I just personally don't see it. But if it works for you, that's great. For me, I'm just having a harder time picturing it.
I don't know. I just have a lot of fun with it, thinking about, you know, because we, you know, we're just like actually going back to what Kate did of like, smoke monster likes to fuck with people sometimes. And I think that this could be a fun way for the smoke monster to do so, using the guise of someone who like this group of people don't really know about, right? You know, Charlie saying like, oh my God, he died. Honestly, I'd rather have this than the Andrew Divoff blooper make its way into canon.
The Andrew Divoff blooper.
Where he's clearly breathing when he's passed out. Let's be completely honest. It's a blooper. It's a flat out mistake.
Yeah, it's a mistake. Like, it's a mistake for sure.
Yeah, so I'd rather have that than have to then retcon, be like, oh, he was alive the entire time.
I mean, I don't know that like I need to see him breathing to be like, he was alive the whole time. Like, I think I can simultaneously accept that was a goof. And that he is still alive, and that like that's not canon that he was breathing there right in front of right in front of Locke, who absolutely should have known. Man, that's a funny point though. all right, well let's keep going and keep hyping it up. The further we get into it,
I'm gonna try to keep stoking these flames here.
I'm open. I just don't see it yet. So keep trying. I'm totally open. All right, so we go back. Let's get another flashback going. This is after Sun's on the beach. He's alone by a campfire and watching Claire laugh it up with Aaron and being like, oh man, it's good to have a baby.
I'm never gonna experience that.
Yeah. And so in the flashback, she goes and she seeks out King Daddy Kwan himself. Woo! Jin's father back in the house. And again, this is just another situation where it's like there are not enough MVP spots in this episode, because I just want to dunk five onto King Daddy Kwan right now.
I know. And like, he is just such Jin's father's a damn good person. It is interesting. You know, Sun has like a file photo of him. Was she using like the John Locke-esque PIs to find him, or internal files to find this guy?
Yeah. No, I love it. She did a great job here. She's got a lot of resources Sun has at her disposal. So good job, Sun. And it's just so great to see Jin's father back on the show. And he is lovelier than I remember, Mike.
Well, yeah. Well, especially this episode, he is going to prove that, like, whether past, present, or future, this is a good man down to his bones.
Yes. Well, let's listen to the good man. We've got a sound of this conversation between Jin's father and son. We will do the translation after the fact. But I think just to hear it, just like to feel like the emotion in the voice, I think is gonna be great.
감사합니다.
그래. 결혼식은 잘 치렀겠지?
네, 멋있었어요. 제 생에 가장 행복한 날이었거든요.
그래. 그건 그놈도 그랬을 거다.
아버님, 왜 저희 결혼식에 오시지 않으셨어요?
그놈이 나에 대해서 뭐라고 하든
그 사람은 아버님이 돌아가셨다고. 왜요?
자신의 과거가 부끄럽고 창피해서.
그래서 아버님은 진수 씨가 어렸을 때 어머니가 돌아가셨다고 말씀하신 거예요?
그놈 애미. 그자 남자가 많았어. 그놈을 낳고 바로 떠나버려서 혼자서 내가 그놈을 키웠어. 내가 그놈의 애비인지도 확실치 않아. 그렇지만 그 핏덩이를 누가 키우겠어? 아가야, 정말 이쁘구나. 내 아들이 사랑하는 여자를 만나게 되어 정말 기쁘구나. 진수에게는 날 만났다거나 지 애미가 살아있다는 말은 절대 하지 않았으면 한다. 절대로 이 늙은이를 봐서라도 이 사실로 은인에게 자존심이 다치지 않았으면 해.
Love it. I love it. I love the whole scene. You know, effectively, it's like he's catching up on, like, how was the wedding? Tell me about the wedding. And he's like, why weren't you there? He's like, well, what did Jin tell you? He's like, your dad. He's like, yeah, you know, don't blame him. It's the shame thing. Like, he's just so good. He's just such a good dad.
I mean, to loosely quote Yondu from Guardians of the Galaxy 2, like, he may not be Jin's father, but he is his king daddy.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
That, I think, is honestly all you need to see to tell how good this guy is, where he admits, like, yeah, I mean,
I'm definitely his dad. I might not be the father, but I'm definitely his dad. I raised this kid.
Yeah, and that's like, and then on top of that, you know, I think other people would be offended of, like, oh my God, I can't believe he didn't say anything about me. But no, he is just super, I don't know, super sincere, super humble about everything, saying, like, yeah, it totally makes sense. Obviously, there's this whole theme of shame that gets brought into this, which I think is very societal, specifically in the Korean construct. And you can see how it, you know, works on different levels, almost like from a parasite perspective, where it does work from Sun's level of, oh, you don't want Jin to know about this because it'll bring shame onto your house. But even it works in the reverse where, oh, you don't want to know that, you know, his father was a poor fisherman, because that also brings shame onto the character of Jin. It's, you know, the idea of everyone protecting Jin from this idea of, you know, living a worse life because of them, I think is a very interesting concept as well, considering, like you said, Jin himself seems to be a very protective character on his own. To have other characters sort of reciprocate that back to him is a part of the equation that I don't think we really got to talk over until this episode.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's just great. And like the chemistry between him and Yun-Jin Kim, just really, really top notch. Makes you want to see more of King Daddy Kwan on the show. I believe this is it, right?
Yeah, this is it. We don't hear from it. And there's that really subtle but like really cute move where he like wipes off his hands on his shirt before he like very gingerly touches her on her chin to admire. Because this is him meeting his daughter-in-law as well. He loves Jin more than anything in the world. And this is the woman who Jin loves more than anything in the world. So like he has so much appreciation for her too. And really makes Sun feel like, damn it, you know, if my dad wasn't such a dick, like, I'd want to adopt you as my father.
Yeah. Oh, God. He's just so, he's a great character. It's so rare to have, like, the uncomplicated, like, good person on the show. And
exactly.
Here he is.
Like who has no agenda, right?
None.
Isn't being nice for any other type of motive outside of just wanting to be a good person in the world. Like, completely, by far, the most altruistic character on Lost. Far away.
I love him. I love him so much. In fact, I love him so much, Mike, that let's just take a quick break to just, like, savor how much we love Jin's father. And we'll be back in just a second.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
All right, let's get back into it, Mike. Let's get back into the episode. We go back to the beach. Sun's sleeping. Juliet shows up. Classic other move to, like, wake you up with a hand to the mouth.
Yeah, though it's also, like, I don't know, maybe a little bit, a little intense for what they're going to do. Could have just been a nice ask, but, and it doesn't help that people are still a bit wary of her, specifically Sun. Sun seems to, like, have taken the torch from Saeed and Sawyer of just being super sus of Juliet in this moment. So it doesn't help when, a la someone like Claire, Juliet clamps her hand over Sun's mouth and says, like, come with me right now.
Yeah. Oh, man. So that doesn't work. That shouldn't work very well, but it does work here where Juliet's like, look, if you come with me, maybe you got a shot.
There may be hope for you yet, I believe is what she says.
Come with me if you want to live. So they're going to the staff. There's an ultrasound machine in there. And Sun's like, wait, wasn't it abandoned? And Juliet's like, yeah, they didn't know where to look. And not for nothing, in a few scenes, they're going to be in the staff. And Juliet's just like going to go to a locker, open it up, and there's like a very obvious lever in the locker that she just like pulls. And it's like, if Kate, Claire, and Russo spent like five more minutes there.
Yeah, well, even Kate was the one that was in the locker room, right? That's where she saw the beers. Maybe she was so distracted by the
retroactive LVP point to Kate Austin.
Yeah, but she was so distracted by the Dharma brand spirit gum that she didn't even look to the top group of lockers where, yeah, there was a secret hidden bookcase that leads to an entirely different room.
But also on top of that, there is the whole fact that, like, Jack and some people and, like, Saeed, like, maybe you guys should have scoped out the staff. You know, and, like, not just, like, taking the word for it that it's empty. And if, like, you believe that it's empty, then what's the risk of going and seeking it out and searching it a little bit further? So I have a demerit to the entirety of 815, Mike.
Maybe Jack's just like, I spend too much time in dark, dank.
Yeah, I'm done with underground lairs. You know what?
How many chains are on the walls in the staff? That informs whether or not I go or not.
Come on, guys. Like, I understand Jack has a bit of an excuse. He was kidnapped for a time.
To that point, actually, so going to the Jim Fells of it all, there's a sting that plays when they explore the staff later on. That played not only when Kay and Russo and Claire explored in maternity leave, but also when Saeed explored the flame in Enter 7-7, and when Locke explored the swan in Adrift. So, yeah,
like
it's a very clearly reverberating thing of, yeah, a lot of our characters like to explore Dharma stations. Just this particular one was quarantined for whatever reason by those three women who went there.
So Juliet's going to tell Sun, like, I'm going to use the ultrasound to determine the DOC, the title of this episode, the date of conception. And if you got pregnant on the island, you're in trouble. But if you got pregnant off the island, you are not in trouble. So when did you last have sex with your husband? And someone's like, hey, let's not talk about that.
And I will say, throughout this entire thing, Juliet is broaching this in a bedside manner that Jack Shepard could only dream of.
He could only dream of having,
Jack would be like, I'm sorry, you're going to die. Juliet is so soft and careful about it. And granted, she probably has had a lot of experience with it, considering that 9 people have died on her watch on the island. But like, even in this moment, Juliet isn't outright saying that Sun will die. She's saying, well, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Right. But the problem here is that Juliet comes with the context of being one of the others.
Right.
Right. Comes with the context of being somebody who has hurt these people before. So for Sun to like really buy in on Juliet right away, she's going to need to see a little bit more than just bedside manner, which she does, of course. Flashback time. Sun is she needs that 100K because Jin's father was like, yeah, spare him the shame. So she's like, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to spare him the shame and need the money.
So she walks in on Mr. Pig having a conversation with several employees. And actually, if you translate the Korean, it's a really interesting thing. The employee says, we haven't received the forged conveyance permit yet, Mr. Chairman. And Pig responds, I heard the Hanso Foundation is filled with anger at the fact that our side didn't offer the equipment. Yeah, so a bit of a linking. You know, you have talked before about how one of your regrets with Lost is that they didn't link Pig too much with the Winmore stuff. Here's a bit of a link to the Hanso Foundation.
Interesting. Yeah, I think Pig secretly being tied into this more, certainly it's something I would explore in Lost too, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, especially here, if there's involvement with the Hanso Foundation, like, maybe some of that stuff on the island was made via, like, 70s-era Paik Corporation.
G-Eon in the Paik industry is a very important piece of Lost, too.
I think so.
Very critical component of the sequel to Lost. We'll talk about that at some point in the far future, hopefully. But Sun comes, and she's like, I need the money. And Mr. Paik's like, all right. You can't do this no questions asked, even though that's what you want to do. This is a world where questions get asked.
I still like how he has, just in his little safe behind him, just $100,000 of spare change.
What an incredible life, you know?
Yeah,
You need 100K? Well, let me just, like, wheel around in my chair and open this safe and just very casually take out some fat stacks of cash.
Yeah, I mean, that might have been a bit of a brag on Paik's part. He's like, just so you know, that's mostly like newspaper clippings. I actually have $100,000 in the bank over there. I just bring this out to really, prop myself up as a big guy. But Sun is sort of showing shades of what we'll see her as in, I believe, the No Place Like Home, when she approaches Winmore of, like, hard businesswoman Sun, when she essentially does like a quid pro quo here of, hey, I know you want no questions asked. Just so you know, like, I have not been blind to all the shady crap you've been doing my entire life. If you want to give me the money, I'll make sure I don't rat you out at all, Father.
Yeah. And he's like, you know, I appreciate what you're going for here, but it's not quite enough. Not quite enough. I'm going to ask some questions. It's pretty clear that this is for Jin. And so Jin's going to be, since this is for Jin, he's going to bear the debt. He's going to work for me directly now. So this is a big piece of why Jin becomes a hitman for Mr. Pig.
To that point, though, and I had this thought while watching the episode, how comparable is Jin's situation to this Desmond-esque idea of the path? This idea of almost a scenario you cannot escape, because Sun, in trying to do all this and pay off his mother, is trying to have him escape shame. But he almost ends up in an equally, if not more so, shameful situation with all of this dirty work and literal blood on his hands that he does as Mr. Pig's
bitch.
Yeah,
it's a tragedy, Mike.
So it's this idea of, again, you can try to change the course of events that are in front of you, but usually things are going to work their way back to sort of a core
final
central conclusion.
Yeah,
so I just think it's, like you said, very tragic and very interesting in that regard, and that, like, she accidentally conscripts him to doing probably much worse things than if they just found out that his mom was a prostitute.
100%. So let's go to Jin. He's in the jungle in the night watching as Mikhail is trying to figure out what to do with Naomi. And he's like, what does she have? And he's like, well, she's got this fancy radio phone. He's like, fancy radio phone.
Okay, my pocket's looking very big right now.
Yeah, and Hurley's like, Count Jacula? And Hurley's like, I don't know about that.
Yeah, and then also a fun little thing of like truth, like non-lying Hurley, where he immediately fesses up to the sat phone, and Mikhail's like, does it work? And Hurley goes, no, but I wouldn't tell you.
I wouldn't tell you, really trying
to recover from that slip-up.
So funny. So Mikhail is going to perform field surgery. He punctures her lung. He pops a needle. It's very gooey, very gross, and very sudden, too.
Yeah, very visceral. I think not since the days of, like, the stuff going on with Boo and have we really seen this much gore on Lost.
See, I'm loving all this stuff with the Mikhail stuff and what he's pulling out of this group. And I think, like, even let's open it up to your interpretation of the Man in Black. So if this were the Man in Black, this is the kind of shit that the Man in Black does do. Like, he inspires, like, mistrust and engenders suspicion within a crew. And so there's just, like, this feeling of tension that is happening here. Within this group.
Let's talk about the Portuguese for a second to that point, because Naomi next moves into her setting, moves her language setting and moves into Portuguese. Mikhail claims that Naomi said, thank you for helping me. But actually, if you do the literal translation of the Portuguese, she says, I am not alone. And so this is, again, Desmond and Charlie are going to give him sort of leery looks when he claims that. And they have every right to be, because this is when Naomi's going to start to reveal what we find out in the ending here. Basically, Naomi is saying that she is not alone. Mikhail's claiming that that's, you know, she did not say that whatsoever. You could look at what that reasoning is. Again, it may be referring to the Man in Black of it all. Maybe he wants to, again, create more chaos with the idea that more people are coming and they don't want to necessarily arm the candidates in anticipation for them. But definitely getting some seedy looks from even someone like Desmond, who's like, oh, okay, maybe I shouldn't be as trusting to you as I thought, even though you're pretty good with a hypo here.
If it's just Mikhail and it's just him straight up and it's just this guy, like, I think that this is another thing where it's like he is just like this person who you can never ever trust. He's just like a constant liar. He's just like he's totally of the Benjamin Linus school of thought. That is his guy. That like he is very loyal to Ben to a fault, and that's because like he and Ben do things the same way. Mm-hmm. And so like he hears the phone. Let's put a pin in that. He hears what Naomi is saying. Let's put a pin in that as well. And when we see Mikhail next, I believe in the very next episode. It's either the next episode or the one after that. He's going to, you know, tell Ben, you know, there's some shit going down. Like there's some people coming here because he's got this intel.
Right.
So this is very important stuff for him as it relates to Ben Linus. That like we've got a problem, sir.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure I think it might be Man Behind the Curtain in which he appears next. Yeah, so we'll have an episode off for Mikhail, because I know
that John Locke has to kick the shit out of him. So that's either going to happen in the Brig or that's going to happen in the Man Behind the Curtain, because after the Man Behind the Curtain, we're done with John Locke effectively for the season, except for one or two scenes.
Right, exactly. So yeah, I believe that happens in the Man Behind the Curtain. Then he's off to the Looking Glass.
Off to the Looking Glass. All right, so let's go back to what's going on with Sun and Juliet as they reach the staff. And it is, like, again, to the credit of Fred Toy, it has huge future Westworld vibes, right? Like, you can really see where some of that Westworld work goes. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it's episode 6 of Westworld is the one that I'm thinking of that has this really big moment at the end of the episode that this feels very evocative of. For me.
Yeah, luckily nobody gets their head smashed against a wall in this
one. No head smashing that occurs, but like it feels like a horror movie. Like you expect like a xenomorph to be rounding the corner at any moment. It's just really effectively shot. I think it's one of the most successfully rendered creepy settings on Lost in a good little while.
Yeah, and I think that it also speaks to, again, the callback to Maternity Leave, which in and of itself was like a pretty horror/thriller-themed episode, especially with how eerie the you know second version I will say of the staff was. But Juliet regarding it like it's just her daily business shows again how at this moment the others are so separate from 815 that they look down a spooky forest and see nothing but horror and dread, and this one's like, yeah, it's just another Tuesday.
Yeah. So we've got a sound here. Where are we starting? Sun and Juliet are going to start talking.
Yeah, so this is after they do some establishing shots, like you said, and Sun is finally going to ask Juliet why she is so adamant about helping her out here. And Juliet, to your point earlier, is going to come clean about how this might be a bit of a beneficial storyline for her as well.
Why are you doing this?
What?
Helping me.
Once upon a time, I told women that they were pregnant, and their faces, it was the best news they ever got in their entire life. And I came here. I've lost 9 patients in the last 3 years. I'm helping you because I want to tell you that you and your husband got pregnant before you came here. I'm helping you because I want to give good news again. I slept with another man. Oh, before we got to the island. Jin and I, we were having trouble. We weren't. And I had a friend. It was a mistake. We all make mistakes.
Can I just say, I think actually one of the underrated elements of this episode, I really like this Sun-Juliet pairing.
Yeah! I mean, I think both Yeonjun Kim and Elizabeth Mitchell are really top shelf in this episode.
Yeah.
They both have stuff going on in this episode where they just really work it, because this is obviously a hugely important episode for Sun. She's going to make first contact with Ji-Eon, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she's going to see the heartbeat. And for Juliet, like, there is both, like, once again, like, the cause for concern, but also the fact that, like, she has given good news to a woman who understands the stakes, even. And, like, maybe for the first time, like, feels, like, kind of normal to an extent, but also that's contrasted against the fact that she has this hidden agenda that she's starting to feel worse about. I think it's a great episode for both of these characters.
Yeah, it's so captivating because these are two characters. And also, you know, this is actually talked about in The Lost on Location. And we spoke about this a bit in Left Behind, that there, especially in like seasons 2 and 3, there are not as many scenes like featuring only female characters. That's why Maternity Leave was such an interesting episode as well, is because for some reason or another, the character composition does not necessarily fall to that configuration. And I like this here because these are also two women who have their own convictions, who are capable of duplicity in their own right. And I think Sun sort of sees eye to eye here with Julia, which is why she eventually does come clean with her sex history and says, like, hey, just so you know, I'll answer the question that you asked before. This is what happened. And Juliet simultaneously sees eye to eye back by saying, like, everyone makes mistakes. She's very non-judgmental. Now, look, part of that may be informed with the fact that she was carrying on with a married man prior to him being sent off to go hang with the Taileys, but it's such like a unique interaction between these characters that, to be quite candid, I think is usually forgotten about, because obviously with the whole thing with the Oceanic Six, Sun and Juliet are not going to spend any time together, really. I can't remember how much of season 4 they really spent together, but, you know, once Sun leaves the island, she's not going to see Juliet again, because Juliet dies back in the 70s. So
right. It's
like a really interesting moment of two ships passing in the night. They acknowledge each other and then keep moving in their separate directions.
Really good point. Really, really, really good point. They dig in deeper. Juliet takes them to the secret room. This is where the ladies died. This is where all the moms were taken to die.
Yeah, and I did like, because she did try to play it off initially by Sun saying, why is this room in? And she goes, don't worry about it. And then it's very clear that Sun's like, no. You brought me into creepy, antechamber. You must tell me what it's for.
Yeah, so we'll dig into that a little bit more in just a moment. Back at the camping crew, Mikhail's like, oh, Naomi's going to be fine. You just punctured her lung. Yeah, she'll be fine.
Yeah,
give her a
eventually
day
air
and a half.
Will get in there.
Day and a half. So Mikhail wants to be let go. He's like, Desmond, remember what you said. And Charlie's like, are you actually going to let him go? And Desmond's like, yeah, for sure. like, what did you think I was going to do? Like, actually shoot him in the head with a flare gun? kind of, you know, maybe thought that you were going
to
do that.
Yeah, and Desmond's like, oh, we don't have enough people to make a stretcher and take care of prisoners. Like, dude, if only you had met the tailies, because they...
I was going to say, like, these guys, like, it takes them, like, a night to build a stretcher. The tailies did that in literally, like, they had, like, 5-10 minutes.
Again, say what you want to about Anna Lucia, but she had what was left of the tailies whipped into shape.
Yeah, she knew how to crack a whip and get these guys going on stretcher detail. The stretcher detail on this crew, it's really leaving something to be desired, but Charlie's really upset about this. We can't keep letting these people go. And he's still going to let them go. And then Jin runs after Mikhail,
yeah.
And Desmond's like, what are you doing? And Jin, you know, catches up to him, and he grabs the phone from Mikhail, and he looks at Desmond. He's like, I'm getting the phone, dude! Like, none of you guys are too busy, like, bickering to, like, be looking at this situation at all. This guy just tried to steal our phone!
Yeah, and it turns out that he did, and then Mikhail just simply responds with, you know, like, ain't I a stinker? How could you respect me if I didn't do it?
Why, if he's the smoke monster, does he take the phone?
Again, to, like, help steer the chaos a bit. If they're trying to debate, like, if he sees that Charlie and Desmond are arguing, taking the phone could get Charlie even angrier at Desmond, and that just further puts a huge line between them.
If he's the smoke monster and he takes the phone, should he just get into smoke monster shape and disappear so he doesn't get caught with the phone?
I mean, that could also be, that's an interesting point as well. Maybe he was actually, like, taken and subdued by Jin. I'm not entirely sure how much he was taken by surprise in this manner, if this was all part of the plan.
Yeah. So he gets the phone back from
him. Maybe he's not allowed to hold inanimate objects once he turns to smoky form.
But he does. He has it in his pocket.
Yeah, but I mean, like, if he does...
He can't hold it with his hands?
No, or, like, if he does turn to smoke, like, if the smoke monster had, like, a sandwich in his pocket and then turned to smoke, does the sandwich also turn to smoke?
No, he probably has to, like, destroy or drop the sandwich. And
yeah,
so, like, you know, maybe he could destroy or drop the phone.
What if he instead put, like, the phone in, like, Desmond's bag or something, you know, like, to really be, like, the whole Pete,
from Survivor Philippines. Idol. Yeah, yeah, fake phone. Fake phone.
That'd be interesting if he swapped the phone out for a fake sap. But imagine, like, through the looking glass,
Island BlackBerry.
Like, I'm gonna call the freighter, and it's just like, wait, these are stickers. Who replaced the phone?
Desmond is gonna still let Mikhail go. We gave our word, Charlie. He lets him go, and in so doing, Desmond kills Charlie.
Yeah, I mean, essentially...
That's an interpretation, at least. Like,
I mean,
you know,
he lets
this man go, this guy's gonna blow up a hand grenade outside of the looking glass. Charlie does lock the door, so Charlie makes the choice. He could probably get out of there in time. But, you know, if not for this decision, none of that happens.
Why? So let's talk about Desmond's POV here. Why do you think he is so, like, dead set on... All right, I had my word, so I'll let him go. Is it that honor thing, or was it you mentioned before about, like, how, okay, I have this specific path for how, you know, I see Claire leaving in the helicopter, and the only way that happens is if we let Mikhail go?
Yeah, I don't think he sees it yet. Like, I don't think that this is something that he sees right now. Is it something that he's going to... Is that going to be an aspect of his flash-forwards later? I would guess not. But I don't know. I don't know. But in doing any of this, Mike... this is very bad news for Charlie.
I mean, you would think that Desmond sees a Dharma Initiative uniform on this guy. Like, I would not be surprised if he was the one pulling a Jin and, like, farcusing this guy. Like, oh my god, I hate the Dharma Initiative. Are you another Inman? Do I have to beat your head against the rocks again?
It's a good point. Like, why doesn't he ask him, are you him?
Yeah,
what do you
exactly.
Want snowman,
like,
say to the other snowman?
Yeah, exactly. And Mikhail, I mean, would have responded with in fair, and then maybe that would complicate things further with Desmond of, like, oh... Okay, what does this mean then? You know, now I'm sort of torn between what I was sort of a part of 3 years of my life, and now this, like, new group of people that are telling me one thing.
He's got such tunnel vision on Penny that he's not really being nearly as curious about Mikhail as I think that he should be.
Agreed.
And I don't know if I want to assign that to such tunnel vision about Penny or. The less charitable thing is that, like, this is just sort of like a poorly written Desmond bit. Either way, I don't think it's especially flattering.
No.
And I think we are running into another episode here where your boy Desmond is looking a little grim on the show.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the most perfect character we've had so far, besides King Daddy Kwan, takes a hit last episode, and I think it's safe to say that streak may continue this episode.
All right, so back at the staff, Sun is going to tell Juliet about Jin and how he's infertile, and Juliet's like, oh, well, that shouldn't be an issue. Because here on the island, the sperm count gets magnified by like 5 times. So he's probably going to be all right.
And Jun does point out, like, essentially I'm in a lose-lose situation right now, because either I'm going to die or this baby isn't Jin's, which again speaks again to sort of like Jin's lose-lose situation in the flashbacks of like either he's the son of a prostitute or he has to now be a hitman, that both of the Kwans, unfortunately, at least in the moment from their perspective, find themselves in like inescapable misery, as it were.
In the flashback, before we start going into the scanning, Jin is going to find that moolah, a smooth $100K in the son. What are you doing with all
this is a bad look for son to just leave it in her purse, as like Jin is just, you know, especially when she says, oh yeah, get this out of my purse, and she realizes it after the fact. But like, Jin is very hurt by this, because he takes it as, you know, she tries to cover it by being like, oh, I thought we could afford more furniture and a nice honeymoon. And that still hurts Jin, obviously less so than, hey, your mother was a prostitute and abandoned you. But also basically telling him like, yeah, I know that you said that like you'd help make money for us, but also I went behind your back to get money from my dad.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, hey, you know, just give it some time. I'll make enough money. We'll have a sweet honeymoon. And there's a piece of it that's like, just let Sun pay for the honeymoon, man. Just let her do it.
Right,
she can do it. She wants to do it.
But this is also like, speaks to the tragedy that comes with these Kwan flashbacks, right? Of like, unfortunately, societal standards and men being the breadwinners. But yeah, I agree. Like, listen, I do not care whatsoever if it is on my wife's dime or not. Like, I'm going to take advantage of a nice vacation if I can have one.
Yeah, send me away. That sounds great. I love it. But then we get the I love you madly. They never really say this to each other again. It's like it kind of just exists in this episode, right? As far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, again, that white flower from House of the Rising Sun when he brought it with him to the airport. I don't think they really tell. It's not really a catchphrase that carried over. Maybe that's.
Well, I would have liked it if it was in the final scene of the two of them, right?
Yeah.
What if they said, I love you, and she says madly, and he says madly, and then the hands.
Well, I believe they probably did, but it was actually like, I love you.
Oh, God. Oh, too soon.
Too soon.
Still too soon.
We'll be getting that in from a while now, but it's a really sweet but like so mournful line of, I will always take care of you, son, because you can feel that in the pit of her heart of like, he's just so sweet seeming in this moment when she knows, just like, and she hasn't even done the affair yet she's still doing stuff behind his back without him knowing.
So let's go back to the island, back to the staff.
Yes.
We've got the sound to play here, and remarkable scene coming up.
There it is. There's your baby. You see?
I can see it. Is it a boy or a girl?
Oh, it's a little early. But,
do you see that little flutter?
That's the heart beating.
Very strong, it's very healthy. Okay. You crashed here 90 days ago. The baby was conceived about 8 weeks ago. So, 53 days. You got pregnant on the island. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, son. I will do everything that I can.
It's just...
Now, Mike, did I mishear that, or did she say, it's Jim's?
Yeah, and then Jim Halpert comes in like, whoops.
It's Jim's. It's Chef Jim's.
Oh, no. Well, not Chef. That's Chef Jeff.
Chef Jin's. Chef Jin's.
Oh, it's just such an incredible scene.
Hyunjin Kim!
Yeah,
Hyunjin
Kim kills it in this scene. Just like... the turn from sadness to happiness in her performance. The simplicity yet complexity of it's Jin's. Like, I mean, listening to... just even listening to... the ultrasound and like her reaction and Juliet's reaction as well to the baby being alive, like really, I mean, it brought back a lot of sense memories for me when my wife was pregnant. And like, just there is something about like actually seeing and hearing your baby that really like connects with you on just almost like a subhuman level. And you can feel that son's feeling that here, that it almost doesn't matter that she now has an expiration date, according to Juliet, right? Like right now, she's living in this moment. She's living with the happiness that not only does she actually have a baby, but that it is her husband's, that all of the guilt and anxiety that she has had ever since she found out that she was pregnant, all the way back a season ago, I think, to the episode in The Whole Truth, all of this now has dissipated away, and it's a weight lifted off her shoulders. And granted, it's going to be another different weight put on her shoulders, but at the moment, she feels weightless, and you hear that and see that so much in her performance. It's so lovely.
I love it. I love it so much. A great moment for both Yeon-jin Kim and Elizabeth Mitchell here as Sun and Juliet. Really, really spectacular scene. One of the best scenes of the episode, certainly. I think one of the best scenes from a Sun flashback.
I was
going to
say, I know we
talked
about Jin's Mount Rushmore last week. I think we're going to have to put this on the Sun Mount Rushmore this week.
It's just great. I think Yeon-jin Kim is just such an expressive actor. I think like she does some things, she makes some choices that really, really sits with you. When you think of like some of like the best emotional moments of Lost, like her screaming on the chopper at the end of season 4 is really readily going to come to mind, and it's a shame if this one doesn't come to your mind either, because this is a really, really beautiful moment.
And let's also really marinate in this moment, because finally, Josh, finally we can put to rest the Jay Lee, whose baby is this storyline. Thank you, Juliet. We have finally put that thing to bed.
So that's done. In the flashback, final flashback of the episode, Son's going to fork over the money to Jin's mom.
And what I noticed was I don't know if it's the same location as when Jin and Son met each other. When we saw an ooh and found, but
it is effectively, because I believe that is just like the same spot in Honolulu that they keep.
Yeah,
filming
it's just that same bridge. But I love that whether actually meant to do it or not, it feels very poetic, right? In that like this is where Sun met Jin, and this is the place that she goes back to, is to essentially protect Jin. For some reason, she keeps coming back to this specific location.
Yeah, she has a badass line to Jin's mom. It says, you know how powerful my family is. My husband thinks you're dead. Don't make me make that a reality. Sick burn.
Yeah, I mean, she has to get her digs in a little bit. She did just get $100,000. So it's like, hey, you know what? You're not going to get that without like getting a bit of a talking to from me.
So that's the end. That's the end for that character. Meanwhile, back at the staff, this is where Sun is starting to like maybe contemplate a little bit more what everything means. So she's got about 2 more months, because she's...
Which is fine. That's like 3 more Lost seasons, considering how quickly these things go.
So she's like, okay, cool. So I can be here for a minute. So she's very happy that the baby is Jin's. You gave me good news, Juliet. So Juliet and Sun, tensions have thawed for now. I think like once the recording comes up, that might not be great. But for the time being, they're on the same page. And Juliet's like, all right, well, I just got to go back in. I got to do a thing real quick.
Yeah, at least she didn't pull a Paolo and was like, I'm going to the bathroom.
I have to use the bathroom real quick. So she goes back into the staff and leaves a message for Benjamin Linus.
Ben, it's 6 a.m. on Saturday morning. Quan is pregnant. The fetus is healthy and was conceived on island with her husband. He was sterile before they got here. I'm still working on getting samples from the other women. I should have Austin's soon. I'll report back when I know more. I hate you.
Oh, crap. Is this still recording? April Fools.
Delete. Hang up. Start over. We should isolate Juliet's "I hate you" to just like bust that out every time we see something terrible on Lost.
Yeah, or just like to like demarcate the LVPs from the MVPs.
Yeah. I hate you. Yeah. It also bothered me on the rewatch and then hearing it now. Ben, it's 6 a.m. on Saturday morning. Well, that's what the AM is. Why do you have to tell us it's Saturday morning, too?
I was also intrigued that it was 6 AM, which I guess I don't know how early or late Juliet woke up, son, because it was in the dark when they went to the staff. I don't know how long they spent there, but it's 6 AM. People are just getting up to eat their Dharma cereal by the time that they came back.
Ben, it's 6 o'clock on Saturday morning. How about that?
Yeah, maybe she's sort of trying to be like the time temperature forecast person. Whenever the clock turns like 6 or 7 on the hour on some of these news channels, they just sort of give it to them right there. I also remember at the time the specific mention of like, I'm going to get Austin's sample soon. I remember there was a lot of conversation now being pushed of like, wait a minute, could Kate be pregnant now? And then we get into like, wait, we made our way out of one pregnancy drama, Josh, into another possible whose baby is this drama, if indeed Kate is pregnant.
I think that they lean into this in a way that makes the future Aaron reveal pretty shocking.
Yeah.
So they're setting, I don't know if this is deliberately to set that up or if that's just something that they realize is hanging there that they can use. But either way, it sets that up, whether that's intentional or not, you can debate. All right, so let's close out the episode. We go back to the camping trip. They've made the stretcher. The tailies are laughing in their grave right now. It took you a whole day, huh? Say what you will about us, but we made good stretchers. Desmond and Charlie are still arguing. Desmond has the shot at Charlie that, by my count, you've killed more of them than they've killed of you.
Yeah, but also if we're using the collective you, he doesn't necessarily know about, you know, Goodwin breaking Nathan's neck or a bunch of other people die.
Yeah,
but,
it's complicated.
Also,
man.
They do, you know, kidnap children.
Some stuff that's not so great. So that's happening with Desmond and Charlie, and then the episode ends with this great moment with Hurley that is the basis of one of the great Hurley gifs on the internet.
Mom?
Where am I?
Take it easy. You just hit a giant branch.
Where am I?
I don't know. You're on an island. Are you here to rescue us? Are there more of you? Can you make your phone work?
Who are you?
Hugo Reyes. I crashed here on Oceanic Flight 815. A bunch of us survived. Is that why you're here? Were you looking for us?
815. Flight 815. The one from Sydney.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not possible.
Yeah, I know. It wasn't easy, but we found food.
No.
And the hatch.
No, Flight 815, they found the plane. There were no survivors.
What?
In fact, they were confirmed dead, as we'll confirmed talk about dead. In like 5 weeks from now.
I love it. I love the what?
Yeah, I love that both the first act break and the final act break was like built to music, Hurley saying one word and then cut to the commercial.
Mom?
Yeah,
that's
dad?
Really good. Yeah, dad.
Yeah, so essentially,
it's a shame that we don't have this typed out. The mom, because that'd be a great emoji.
Yeah, this is the text to speech version of the ending of what Kate did.
Mom, so that's good. That's great.
Imagine if Carmen Reyes did pick up. That'd be the trippier ending.
That'd be amazing. That'd be great. All right, so everyone's dead.
Yes.
So it's like, oh God, what does this mean? And this was like another big talking point for the week off.
Right, exactly. Of like, this woman's, I don't know who she is, but she knows Desmond, and she's bringing in information, including that apparently everyone on Flight 815 is dead. Now, this also brought in, like, not necessarily, like, this is completely true, but, like, could this be Naomi lying? I mean, it turns out that she was telling the truth. It's just more so that this was something that was hidden.
It's complicated.
It's complicated, but I think it definitely brought question marks, not only for the status of 815, but for the status of this new character, Naomi, as well.
I like it. I think it's a great stinger for the episode,
yeah.
And it's once again advancing the Naomi mystery, so as we're just kind of, like, barreling towards the end game of the season, I think it's really, really fun stuff. Let's get into some feedback, Mike. This is from Stefan Johnson, who writes, and do you think that Jin and Sun have more exciting flashbacks throughout the series than their on-island stories? Where do you stand with that, Mike, as the big Jin Sun stan on the podcast?
I mean, so if I'm going through, because again, we're sort of like a moratorium on outright regular Kwan flashbacks here. I think House of the Rising Sun and Ooh in translation are incredibly fantastic flashbacks, especially doing the whole Rashomon method of showing Jin's side of things as we see Sun watch his transformation, I think are beautifully done and shows again how like the poetic lack of communication between them, despite wanting to protect each other, has led to this moment. I think Ooh and Found has really cute, it's a cute flashback. It's not necessarily as weighty as those two, but this is their sort of their when they met each other and where they were. I mean, we talked about how like I'm not a big fan of the Jay Lee stuff. So the whole truth and the glass ballerina, I'm really not actually big fans of. And I think this was fine enough. You know, I think if we do weight their flashbacks, maybe compared to like all characters, maybe they're a bit above replacement level, but I would not necessarily say that like every flashback Kwan scene that we get is fantastic. They start off incredibly strong and there's some very solid stuff in there, but I would not necessarily say it's like as low as some of the Jack and Kate and Locke stuff, but also maybe not as like consistently high as the Desmond stuff.
The Ben Behind the Curtain says, it's the insinuation in this episode that Sun always knew what Jin would end up doing and was responsible for it. And if so, how do you feel about this in the context of the rest of her story?
Right. So as Josh alluded to in the final scene, Sun makes this threat to Jin's mom of like, you know what my family can do, essentially like threatening to off her if she comes back and does anything like this again, which would then imply if she knows what her father is up to, doesn't she think that Jin is now a part of this? I don't know. Maybe she really does like think the best for her father and think that maybe when he was making that offer to have Jin pay the debt, that it wasn't necessarily that he would become a hitman, because maybe that's also is like a personal insult to her of like, you make your son-in-law, my husband, have to do your dirty work. Maybe she was naive about that, because otherwise, yeah, then it maybe is a little bit incongruous to like how much she is so confused and freaks out over when he comes home with blood on his hands, considering that in theory, she would know what the job description is.
Yeah, she sees him come home with blood on his hands and says, ooh, did I do that?
Exactly. Oh, Son Urkel.
Did not have that on the bingo card coming into this episode. Eric Divestein comes in and says, how do you think things would have played out if Sun hadn't given in to the blackmail? If Jin and Sun could have made it through the fallout of the truth coming out, I think they would have been better off in the long term.
The truth coming out. Yeah, I think it's a good point, because you would say that obviously it's all about shame and social status, right? But I also believe, speaking of shame and social status, I don't know how common divorce is in Korea, especially at that time. So, like, you would think on paper, Paik would be like, God, this is terrible. You must divorce my daughter. But I think that would make it almost even worse for him from a public perception standing. So I really don't know, outside of, like, Paik really having even more disregard for Jin than he did before this moment, you know, it certainly wouldn't have led to Jin becoming his hitman, that's for sure.
Probably not, unless after the fact, it's like, the only way is if you let him become my hitman.
Right, so it's again, it's leading towards the same path, but this way it would have to be like Jin making his decision, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that would have worked. And then from Ryan Stanley, one more. How much did the DOC ending feed into the They're All Dead conspiracies at the time, and what were your feelings on it?
Feeding like Hurley at the beginning of Dave/Everybody Hates Hugo.
I think it was pretty, you know, it's fuel for that fire for sure.
Yeah, and I'm actually speaking of Dave, much like Dave was sort of like an underlining/lampshading of the whole theory of, oh, it's all in somebody's head. This is very much, I can imagine, a bit of a tongue-in-cheek reference to the They Were Dead the Whole Time theory.
Yeah, I think so. But they're playing with fire here for sure. You know, there's no question about
that. And I mean, my feelings at the time were like, I think on paper now in retrospect, you'd be like, they would not put that big of a twist in, you know, the sixth episode from the finale. But again, look at something like Lockdown, for instance, where the huge twist of Henry Gale being other, or Two for the Road, where two characters get killed by Michael, didn't happen at the end of the season or the penultimate episode. So Lost has shown up to this point that it does not matter where you lie in the episode order, we're going to drop crazy twists into this show. So I was not necessarily thinking, well, this is clearly not right. I was ready to believe it, episode order be damned.
We're ready to believe you. Tell me about the Jim Fells music analysis this week, Mike.
So outside of that one little sting of exploring the hatches, Sun and Jim's theme pops up 7 times in this episode. Should have been 8. And Yeah, and so that was basically it. Some callbacks to like a freighter stuff when Naomi comes in, since obviously that's what she represents, but largely just a bunch of callbacks to previous instances, which makes sense because this episode does feel like the follow-up to a lot of previous storylines, plus the new addition of Naomi.
Let's get into the MVP LVPs, Mike. I've got three MVPs. You've got three LVPs. Let's just get him back on the board, right? Jin's dad, come on down. I'm going to throw an MVP point on Jin's father.
I'll throw another one on there as well. And unfortunately, yeah, only two at this point. I forgot how many we gave to him for ooh in translation. I think he got a bigger share there. But yeah, we have to acknowledge KDK here, especially in his finale episode. Just such a good character, such a good man.
I wish that I could throw them all his way. I really, really do. But I have to, with my other two MVP points, I have to give one to Jin and I have to give one to Sun. Because I would also like to give five to Jin for his effective beatdown of Mikhail and being the only one who is still level-headed enough to be like, the phone, you idiot!
Yeah.
So Jin just does great work here and also is like, hey, Sun, give the money back. We don't need that. So he's advocating for himself really well
this is a good Jin episode. Granted, again, he's a bit out of the loop, but that's not particularly his fault. He's acting out of the best intentions of his heart, and he's onto things, as you're talking about.
And then I gotta give one to Sun, largely because Yeonjun Kim absolutely kills it here, but I love Sun in this episode so much. I love, like, the turnaround she does on Juliet. I love the way that she internalizes and processes the news about Jin and her baby and getting to see that heartbeat for the first time. I love the way that she throws it back at Jin's mom. I love that scene with Jin's dad. This is an excellent Sun episode, just for the Kwans writ large. Really, really, really strong episode.
So to that point, because I know Stefan Johnson brought it up a bit in the Discord, do you dock Sun any, obviously not from an LVP perspective, but in general for letting Juliet go back into the staff on her own?
I think that she's got a lot going on right now, right? Like, I think she's got a lot. And what's she going to do? She's like, I'm not letting you go back in there by yourself. Like, what kind of power does she have over Juliet in this moment?
I mean, yeah, I would agree. I think also, like, again, if you're looking at the bigger spectrum of things, I would think it's more of a wash. She does some great things. Like, yes, that might be a bigger mistake in that, you know, had she not done that, Juliet doesn't send the message. But at the same time, I think it's a much different situation than somebody we're about to get into. But let me actually finish up the MVPs really quickly by speaking of Juliet. I'm going to give her a point here because she's able to get that happy ending. She's able to give the good news. And also, again, thank you, Juliet, for finally putting an end to this whose baby is this storyline. Definitely one of my least favorite Kwan storylines in Lost history. So I'm very happy it's at an end now.
All right, so let's go into the LVPs and let's just get into it because you're talking about Desmond.
Yeah, so Desmond, I'm going to throw a point on here. I'm
coming with you.
Yeah, so you're coming with. I think that it's just not a great look for Desmond. Yes, I know that like Sun, he does let another go here. Why are we letting Sun off the hook but not Desmond? Because Sun does more good stuff in this episode than bad.
Well, also Desmond's got a flare gun.
Yeah.
So he still has the ability to hold one over on Mikhail. He also has a Jin. Which he could unleash on Mikhail at any point in time.
Desmond sees that Mikhail, like, in front of his own eyes, is undercutting him, right?
He broke the terms, he broke the deal, and not only that, they are letting the medic go on his word that she will be fine in a day. So the terms should be like, you're sticking around until we know that she's going to round the corner here.
Yeah, I think it's completely impractical to...
He does a terrible job as the leader of this group.
Yeah, I think it's completely impractical for him to not take Mikhail hostage. I know he was not there with Kate and Saeed and Locke when they did it in Enter 7-7, but it's much more manageable to do than I think Desmond was letting on, you know, to have a prisoner and have a stretcher. It's a position Mikhail has been in before. Like, it could very easily be done. I'm not sure why Desmond's insistence in this episode is that he does indeed need to let him go, even if, to your point, Mikhail breaks his promise. But
we don't need to kill this man. That's not something that... No one's asking you to kill this guy, except maybe Charlie. But, like, keep him prisoner.
Yeah, keep him prisoner back. And just make sure that Charlie doesn't get his hands on the flare gun. That's all you need to do.
And, you know, cross-check his stories with Juliet's, right? Like, this could be very good for the camp and the whole situation right now.
Right, and now you have an extra piece of ammo, too, in that Juliet... claim she was left behind. Here's a guy who can't say the same thing. Like, now you have a different piece of ammunition you can use against the others. And then I'm just going to say right now, the other 3 points between you and I are being thrown on Jim's mom. Definitely
of course.
One of the worst characters we have come into contact with in quite some time.
Yeah, but, you know, she's in there very briefly, and I think that I don't want to let the Desmond thing go, especially because he's such a great character that in the rare moments where, like, they're losing, they're taking their eye off the prize of Desmond, I do think it is worth a moment of meditation. Let's talk about the rankings for DOC. So I said before that I think that this is my favorite of the Quan flashbacks so far. I hold to that after this conversation. I think that there's a lot of fun stuff in here. I think it's very tense in the right ways. The Mikhail fight scene with Jin is a really great scene. There's just excellent acting showcases in this one. It's upping the stakes of they're all dead. Like, I think that this is a really good episode of Lost. And it's going to get a 3.6 from me, which is the same that I gave, I believe, House of the Rising Sun.
And, so I'm not and in translation as well.
And so I'm not going to boost it past either of those, because I don't know. It's certainly not as classic as House of the Rising Sun, I don't think. You know, it doesn't have, like, when I get away from this one again, am I going to forget it again? You know, like, are they going to have to re-up the fee? I don't know. So I think for that's what's keeping me from, like, putting it past House of the Rising Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, I think, like, if you put a gun to my head or a flare gun to my head, yeah, in the future and said you can watch DOC or you can watch House of the Rising Sun, I would probably pick House of the Rising Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I, you know, what in isolation, I think that I would just want to check out, like, a classic season one episode. But I don't know. I think I cannot tell which one is better. I could tell which one I enjoyed more,
mm-hmm.
And right now that's DOC, but I think that it is probably of the same quality as House of the Rising Sun, so I'm just going to keep it at the same score, give it a 3.6.
So I'm going to go to a 3.4, which is actually comparable to another Quan episode, Ooh and Found, which I actually feel pretty, like, on the same level with. I think these are both episodes that, you know, do important things with the Jin and Sun characters. I think more than meets the eye. Like, I remember Ooh and Found were like, oh yeah, this is the episode where Sun loses her wedding ring. It's not really a storyline much talked about. Much like here, I think even the stuff in the jungle with Mikhail showing up, I think in the grand scheme of things is sort of a blip on the radar. But I think there is surprising strength contained within those episodes. I don't think it necessarily supersedes the strength of House of the Rising Sun or Ooh in translation, which I feel like even outside of the Quan-centric stuff has a lot of other great stuff going on around it, really super stuff that pushes those things up. But I feel like it's solid. In general, you know, looking at these past few episodes with One of Us, Catch-22, and now DOC, they've all gotten like 3.4s or 3.5s out of me. I feel like it's a very consistent group mm-hmm. of episodes. And so I also like DOC probably on the same level as I do, like a One of Us, which is admittedly a bit of a sloppier episode, but I think gives me so much emotion and character stake behind it as well. And our audience split the difference here. They gave an average of 3.5. And I think really we got like spanning the threes with DOC, as low as a 3, as low as a 2.8, and then as high as a 3.9. So that's going to average out overall to a 3.49, and that is going to put it 18 episodes so far, smack dab in the middle, number 10 for DOC, right below Enter 77, right above I Do.
Okay, so that's where we're landing with DOC. Now, we are about to launch into some territory that I think is going to shake up these rankings significantly.
Yeah, I would say, you know, this is at number 10 right now. Be prepared for basically...
That's going... be prepared!
I mean, I'll say basically prepare for everything below... below A Tale of Two Cities, maybe even Trisha Tanaka, maybe even The Cost of Living to get pushed down from here on out with the next four to come.
Going to be really interested to see where that's going, because our top of the episodes right now for season three are Flashes Before Your Eyes, The Man from Tallahassee, The Cost of Living, Trisha Tanaka Is Dead. Those are the top four. We've got four more coming. And Mike, this is all the way back in, was it Numbers?
When we talked about the strongest streak of Lost episodes.
I believe that's correct. And so here we are. We're at that moment, Mike. We've about a year later, we have reached
that. Yeah, because
moment.
That was when we were sort of pushing through recording mm-hmm. all those episodes. And so much like
I was going on vacation. Remember those?
Remember vacations? Yeah.
Vacations?
When you were going to your own Asian country, not Korea.
Yes.
But much as we were sort of barreling down there from a production perspective, we were barreling down at season three. And I mean, The Brig is such a huge episode for so many reasons. First, we're getting our own on-island flashback version of John Locke. We're finally getting the questions answered of what the hell was Locke doing ever since we had that Anthony Cooper thing happen in The Man from Tallahassee. I think we're going to have a lot more to say on the point we made a few weeks ago about how this is a very spotty Locke season in the appearances and focus that he gets. But I mean, this is a giant Sawyer episode. Massive. We've been tracking this character, specifically in season three, going from prisoner on Hydra Island to trying to, have this kindling of a romance with Kate, to becoming the foisted upon leader and ingratiating himself in with the group. And now he faces his worst demon, and we see what he does with it. It's a sublime, episode that I have loved ever since it came out. It also, you know, as much as we talked about how much of a big deal the whole the whole Christian Shepherd showing up in Par Avion was, to actually have the "Is Anthony Cooper the OG Sawyer" confirmed was a massive thing.
Massive deal. And I can't wait for that moment. I love the, when he's reading off, when he's like sounding off all of his names, Tom Sawyer. So I'm so pumped. It's going to be such a great episode to talk about. I mean, I've been saying this for a while now, but like the next few episodes are going to be perfect 4.2 is for me.
Yeah.
That's for sure. You know, the Brig through the Looking Glass is all going to be 4.2. It might even extend to the beginning of the end.
I was going to say, like, to the 4.3s? I don't think we can do that.
You know, I don't know. It might go to the season 4 premiere is a great episode, too. So we're in a really, really prime stretch of Lost right now. 4 more episodes of season 3 starting next week. Get your feedback in down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com. You can also tweet at us at post recaps, at Round Howard, at a Mike Bloom type. You can join the Discord by signing up patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Let me give you 2 reasons why you might want to do that. Reason number one.
I thought you were to show your fist when you did that.
Reason number one.
one, two.
Yeah. What are the names of my fists? This is Charlie. This is Hurley. sign up patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Here's what's going on in the Discord. One is, before you get a Down the Hatch podcast, I have started taking to writing out my, I'm watching the episodes and basically like live blogging the episodes as I'm watching them, because I write up my notes so that I can have them handy for the podcast, so you can kind of get like a little bit of a glimpse of what the podcast might be like by reading my notes from the episode. That's happening live on like Mondays, Tuesdays before we watch the episode. So a worthy reason to check it out. Some people have really enjoyed that. I've enjoyed doing it. It's a little bonus Down the Hatch content that you get if you are a member of the Discord. We are also doing a book club, Benjamin Linus and Juliet Burke style, in the Discord, in the Post Show Recaps patron Discord. And the first book that we are reading is Watership Down.
Oh,
it's happening.
Finally.
It's happening.
Taking care of your own personal tasks through the Discord. I love it.
It's happening. You know, we were trying to figure out what's the first book going to be, and we're still working on figuring out, like, what's the first official book going to be, and I floated out as, like, a book zero. Why don't we do Watership Down? I've been meaning to read this for a minute, and it's a book that I'm going to, you know, need to read eventually, so why don't we all go on this journey? And so we're going to do that. We're going to have a live book club conversation about it in the Discord on December 13th. So you have until December 13th to read Watership Down. So think about it. Sign up. It's the beginning of the month right now. It's early on in December. By signing up, you're supporting podcasters like myself, Mike, all of the people who are responsible for the great content that you listen to on Post Show Recaps.
And
if you're a fan of Post Show Recaps,
it's the beginning of the month as well. So you're really going to usually get charged at the beginning of the month for this. So you're really getting your money's due. And we're also approaching month number 3 of the Post Show Recaps Patreon.
We're
as
in
well.
It. This is month number 3. You know, we're there right now. This is also we're looking to get 1,000 patrons by the end of 2020 in order to make the full on community rewatch podcast happen. We're not supremely optimistic about hitting that number, but hey, you can give it a shot.
We want to give good news, people.
You know, we want to give good news. So think about it. If you've been on the fence at all, now is like the absolute best time to do it. If you are flirting with the idea at all, the Discord has been my happy place. I know we talk about it a ton. It's being talked about very often because it is really, really fun in there. And there's lots of great people, lots of incredible Down the Hatch discourse in the Discord. So strong recommend. Check that out. Mike Bloom, you're sprinting towards the end of The Amazing Race right mm-hmm. now over at RHAP.
Yeah, unlike the sprinting that I should actually be training for. But yeah, we are in the final few weeks of that, so that we will see how that finishes. We've also got over here on Poetry Recaps, I, of course, am covering Star Trek Discovery with Jessica Lease as we are nearing, I think, the final few episodes for that. And Josh, I'm going to switch franchises for a hot second this week as I'm going to be pinch hitting for you on yes. the Mandalorian recap this week.
Yeah, so Mike's going to be filling in for me on Mando over at the Mandalorian podcast, so get ready for that. Going to be a really fun time. Lots of great times
can,
here.
Can someone please Photoshop Sun's ultrasound and put Baby Yoda in there instead of Gideon?
He's got a name, sir. I'm not going to spoil it because it's still too soon, but he does have a name now. All right, we will be back next week talking about the Brig. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
I don't hate you.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.